From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made in 2014 at the European Court of Justice. The court ruled that Google had violated a Spanish lawyer's rights by refusing to eliminate links to embarrassing articles about his past. This decision has become a hallmark in the battle over free speech and our ability to get beyond past mistakes. It's known as the Right to Be Forgotten Law, and it sparked some heated debates about our rights to access information versus our rights to expunge our own records. Say you give an interview with a local news station when you were drinking too much and the interview made the air. Should you be able to tell Google to take down the link 5 years later? After all, if you're trying to get a job, a would-be employer might find that interview after a simple search. It could kill your job prospects. What if you were charged with a misdemeanor? What if you shoplifted? What if those embarrassing moments follow you via Google and into job interviews forever? Press freedom advocates say it's dangerous to instruct Google to remove links just because someone finds them embarrassing or wishes they hadn't done something. Privacy advocates say that Europe has the right idea. New York State has floated the idea of a right to be forgotten law in the state assembly, but there hasn't been much traction on a similar bill here. That doesn't mean it won't come back, though. So what do you think? They say the internet is forever, but should it be in this case? Do we have a right to eliminate our past foibles? Do we judge others too harshly? In studio, we have Scott Maloof, an attorney whose practice is focused on the intersection of social media and the law. Scott, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
On the line, we've got Chris Thomas, who's a partner with Nixon Peabody. And Chris's work, among other things in the past, has focused on First Amendment. He's worked with media companies, very familiar with this. Chris, thank you for taking the time for us.
Great to be here.
And let me also say that on the line, we've got a man named John. John's personal story has been a kind of model for a potential law in New York State. We're allowing John to use a pseudonym this hour, and to the best of our ability, we have been able to vet his story as accurate. John, welcome to the program.
Evan, thank you very much. This is John speaking. Thank you for having me.
Thanks, John. And let me start with Scott Maloof, who called the story to our attention just briefly. You know, you're kind of always on top of social media here, and you let us know that, you know, New York State was looking at this. My understanding is that the sponsor of the bill has withdrawn this for now. My guess is it will come back eventually. But why is this on your radar in particular?
The specifics are that the Senate, the senator who co-sponsored the bill has withdrawn his support from it, so there's a bill pending in the New York State Assembly.
Okay.
This is interesting to me because, very simply, it's so much broader than the right to be forgotten that they have in Europe. For example, that particular right lets a person who's in Europe request for various reasons that Google de-index something, so the story would be hard to find on Google. But this would suggest that if, NPR posted a particular story, that story itself would have to be taken down. So it goes much closer to First Amendment concerns.
Okay, and I don't think I'm speaking out of school here to say that Mark Memmott from NPR was in Rochester recently, and we had a chance to talk to him. He shared with us that NPR, and this is not a surprise, because Chris Thomas in a moment will tell us what he's experienced with local media companies. NPR gets requested to do this all the time. I mean, half a dozen to a dozen times a month, they will hear from people saying, hey, can you take this story down? Or, you know, this was a story about me, but that was years ago. It's hurting my job prospects, that kind of a thing. Chris Thomas, to your understanding on local media companies, how often does this kind of request come up?
I would say I see it probably once every 3 to 6 months. And I would imagine that the clients see these more often, and only if they escalate to a higher level do I even get called in on them.
Okay.
So they are quite frequent.
And when you say a higher level, does that mean someone saying, you have to take this down, I'll sue?
I'm going to sue you.
Okay.
Those are the magic words where it ends up on my desk.
Okay. And in general, what have you seen about local media companies, how they respond to people who say, for various reasons, come on, you know, somebody Googles my name, the first thing they see is this story on your page. You can't do that to me. You got to take it down. How do they typically respond?
The first question is an internal review. Was the story accurate at the time that it was published? And they will do an internal review of whether the story itself was accurate. And if it was accurate at the time that it was written, they are highly unlikely to take it down off of their website or anywhere else.
Are they willing to listen to an appeal that the story, even while accurate, is particularly damaging and respond in any kind of a way?
Well, there's always a response, and there's always empathy because we're dealing with, we say media company, and you think of some gray monolithic organization. It's not. The local media companies are our neighbors, they're our friends, they're people that we know, they're people like you, Evan, and they have feelings and the ability to empathize. But by the same token, they are very serious about their right to print true news. And if news has been after a review, found to be true at the time that it was published, the odds of it getting taken down subsequently for really any reason are quite slim.
Chris, in general, do you have a feeling about right to be forgotten laws?
I really don't. I mean, I haven't given it a whole lot of thought. I can certainly understand the reasons that people would advocate for them, and oftentimes, and this all kind of comes from, I think it really started with the pressure that is on our system from the simple fact that we incarcerate so many people and we charge so many people with crimes in our country. I think recent estimates were that something like 25% of American males have some sort of interaction with the criminal justice system, and as a result of that, our statutes that are on the books right now, and Scott can probably speak more eloquently about these, seek to give cover to those people, not cover, but return people, defendants, to an original state if they were found not to have been convicted, or if they were found not guilty, if they received a youthful offender adjudication, if they received what's called an ACD, if their offense was somehow sealed. The human rights law says you can't consider that in a job application. The criminal procedure law says you can't consider, and it actually becomes a nullity that is sealed if somebody receives this thing called an adjournment in contemplation of dismissal. And that's gone one step further, where under the corrections law, an employer can't consider a conviction unless and until it's established that the conviction has a direct relationship to the job that's being applied for, or that the individual, after receiving the offer, is deemed to have an unreasonable risk or pose an unreasonable risk to the employer or the employer's customers. But what we've seen is this desire to put people back into their pre-arrest, pre-conviction status, and this ban the box, and also ban the box is a further step along that line, and the right to be forgotten is the furthest reach of that, because we're talking about stuff, Evan, that never touched the criminal justice system, like the stupid interview you gave when you were drunk when you were 18, and it keeps coming up. So it's a major development. It's a major expansion of the rights that are currently there to be forgiven as opposed to forgotten.
Chris's time is limited, so I've got one more question for the attorneys, and then we're going to let John tell his story. He's on the line with us. But let me ask both Chris and Scott Maloof, the attorneys on the program today, how they feel about what Slate Magazine had to say. Writing for Slate Magazine Online, Eric Posner defended the right to be forgotten laws, particularly Europe's. He writes, quote, "It shows that contrary to stereotype, America is rigidly ideological about free speech, while Europe is pragmatic and flexible." And then he goes on to say that right to be forgotten laws could actually right some wrongs and fill some gaps. So let me read from that, and we'll get Chris and Scott's take on it. Quote, "In many states, people can get their criminal records expunged, removed from the public record, if the crimes are minor. There are countless laws that protect privacy for medical records and for financial information, like past bankruptcies. All of these rules used to make it difficult for the press to get its hands on an old, reputation-damaging information. The advent of the internet, however, has changed everything. Once information is online, it can be forever instantly accessible through search engines. A quarter century ago, there would have been little chance that someone would still have to explain himself to an employer or a landlord or a client or a prospective date. The newspaper story would still exist on microfilm somewhere, but practically speaking, it would be gone. The problem of old embarrassments or troubles living forever online is one that American law does not yet address. End quote. Chris, do you agree with that?
Yes, absolutely right. And that's what I was getting at with my comment about the human rights law, the corrections law, the ACD, and the acquittal. All of those are efforts to, you know, deal with putting people back to their pre-conviction condition. But the simple fact of the matter is the Internet makes all of that different because it's the fact of the arrest is still available. So, I mean, this is it's a nuanced policy discussion that I don't think is going to be resolved anytime soon. I'd be very curious to hear what Scott thinks about it. But I think that, you know, from our perspective, and not for nothing, we've just seen the Trump administration make and the Senate make available for sale people's search histories, internet search histories. And it would seem to me that, you know, we are going into a period where information is going to be even more widely available, not less widely available. And it will only be when there's a real policy determination that ISPs, Internet Service Providers, have to scrub out the fact of an ACD or an acquittal or of an arrest that there's any possibility that these right-to-be-forgotten laws will be adopted here. I don't think it'll happen anytime soon.
It's Chris Thomas, an attorney with Nixon Peabody. Time is short. Thank you, Chris. Always nice talking to you.
Thanks, bye.
All right. Scott Maloof, attorney in studio with me, whose work and his practice focused on the intersection of social media and the law. What do you think about that?
Two things. One, of course, as Chris said, we want to be very sensitive to the needs of the individual and that these stories can harm their reputation, harm their career. But we got to be very careful about what tools we apply to protect the individual. And let me give you a story. This is a case that's already happened. There was a case in Connecticut where a woman was charged with a crime, and the newspapers reported that charge accurately at the time. The charges were dropped. They were nulled, as they say in Connecticut. And the woman demanded the newspapers drop the stories because under Connecticut's law, there was an erasure statute, i.e. you were never charged, you've never been committed a crime, you have no record. That's the Connecticut law. She said, this law gives me the right to demand these accurate stories be removed. And she sued the newspapers who refused for defamation, invasion of her privacy, similar rights, and went up to the Second Circuit, which applies here in New York, covers New York State, and the court said no claim. So that's where we have to be careful. I think it really identifies the concern, which is individuals say, I'm being harmed, but here's someone who took the law to protect them and tried to use it as a sword to attack these accurate stories and force old stories to go away. And that's not, you know, there clearly is a consequence to that.
Okay. Let me go ahead and read from the New York Times, because a lot of people wonder how it would work. And then John, who's on the line, is going to kind of tell his story here, because there's basically two categories of the kinds of stories that people are going to want taken down or expunged from, for example, Google search records, etc. Here's according to the New York Times how it works. Quote, under the ruling, Europeans who felt that they were being misrepresented by search results that were no longer accurate or relevant, for instance, information about old financial matters or misdeeds committed as a minor, could ask search engines like Google to delink the material. If the request was approved, the information would remain online at the original site, but would no longer come up under certain search engine queries. End quote. Again, two categories here. First, Scott Maloof. Big difference between something that's inaccurate versus something that is deemed no longer relevant. Who gets to decide what's relevant anymore? If I'm an employer and Scott Maloof wants to work for me, and yep, 5 years ago, you gave an interview with News 10 NBC, and you were toilet papering your town on Halloween, and you were drunk, and you were acting like a fool in the interview. You may not be happy with that, but I may be able to find it. And I may say, look, I'm not going to base my entire decision on that, but I'd like to see it if it's out there. As an employer, I'd like to be able to know what's available versus something that's inaccurate. Two very different categories, aren't they?
Correct. Correct. And you asked, who makes the decision? In Europe, it's Google that makes that decision.
On what's relevant?
On what's relevant. Google has, because remember, we are talking scale. I think there's been something like 1.7 million requests for Google links to be removed, so results at Google to be removed. So Google's making that decision. So there's a problem right there because we really don't know how they're doing it. And clearly, they're probably using a combination of technology, algorithms, and humans. In the New York statute, it would be a judge who would decide, or a jury, would decide to remove it. And then third, a big point here is self-censorship. Everyone who starts to write and post on the internet, and literally under the New York statute, I mean everyone who's writing, would have to say, is this something that's going to come back later and I'm going to have to remove it on penalty? And we haven't discussed this, of a $250 a day, punishment for not removing this excessive or inaccurate and other types of material. So think about that. That's in 1 month, that's about $7,500 per post.
Yeah, a lot of people would say that stuff is not relevant anymore if it's about them, right?
That's the usual standard, yeah.
I was in college, I was drinking, I was younger. It's not relevant anymore. So,
And there's some truth to that, absolutely, of course.
Okay, well, but obviously there's some debate there. And this is where, by the way, Slate weighs back in to say that they think, in many ways, we think things are way too relevant for too long. And here's Eric Posner writing more for Slate, defending these kinds of laws. Quote, critics say that the right to be forgotten heralded the end of the free and open internet. Well, it could if European courts go overboard. At this point, what really matters is what Google has to do, since few people will discover the old articles without the aid of a search engine. For example, by prominently surfacing a Spanish attorney's old debt woes, Google's search results disclose embarrassing information without providing much continuing value to the public. A private individual's failure to pay a debt more than a decade ago tells us little about his character today. End quote. Do you agree with that, Scott?
I guess it depends on the context. For example, let's take financial services. Those are folks who have all your data, have all your information. I think any kind of financial impropriety by an employee of a financial services company would be relevant, maybe almost in perpetuity. Or if that person has a lot of personal problems in their life that may change who they are. They had a drinking problem 10 years ago. Is that an ongoing concern that could cause them to misuse your financial records or your money? So obviously that could be a concern.
Okay. Let me turn to John, who's on the line with us. Again, John's personal story has been a kind of a model for a potential law in New York State, and we're allowing John to use a pseudonym. To the best of our ability, we've been able to vet his story as accurate. So John, why don't you tell us a little bit about your background and why you got in touch with us today when you knew we were going to have this discussion?
Yeah, thank you, Evan. Well, let me say very briefly a bit about my background, then I'll get into my personal story very shortly, just so people have some idea. I'm an admitted attorney. I'm also a former journalist. I happen to be a huge proponent of the First Amendment, of free speech, and as the expression goes, I'm a very proud card-carrying member of the ACLU. And I was involved in helping to work with this bill, and I think it's very important that people understand what the bill covers and what it doesn't cover, because some people were screaming the sky is falling at the end of the internet. In the bill, I want to make 3 points about the bill in general. There's no prior restraint, first of all. The bill provides a significant lapse of time has to happen. Number two, the bill expressly excludes any material relevant to current public debate or discourse. And those are very important points, because I am for the right to be forgotten because there has to be some rules of the road for the internet. I'll get into my case in a second. But those who were against it, just imagine if the worst moment of your life was put on the internet and Google puts it on the first page of your profile for the rest of your life. Whatever that dumb decision was, maybe you were a teenage kid who got drunk at a party, and it follows you around for the rest of your life. And I would challenge anyone against any form of the right to be forgotten to put on the front page of the New York Times or on the front page of Google the dumbest thing they ever said or the stupidest moment of their life. There used to not be a need for the right to be forgotten because there was a thing called time. If you did something dumb or something stupid, in 5 or 10 or 15 years, it went away on its own. There's an old expression in journalism you might know, yesterday's news wraps the fish, meaning after a certain amount of time, you're wrapping the fish with the newspaper, it goes away. So I hope people at least agree that there has to be some rules of the road for the internet, and whether it's the European model or not, there should be a discussion like Professor Posner was doing about some rules. So let me explain my personal situation and how I got involved in this. Because with me, it's not even something I did. It's what someone else did. Many years ago, about a decade ago, I worked with someone who committed a crime. And when this was all going on, one of the top 10 media outlets wrote a story about this guy. And in the tumult and in the confusion of the moment, they also said that I committed a crime as well, which I did not. And as a result of that article from a top 10 media outlet, and as a result of Google putting it on the first page of my results, it has cost me, as you could imagine, a ton of business, jobs, clients, reputational damage, you name it. So when we discovered this, my lawyers and I wrote to this top 10 media outlet, explained what happened. I was a witness. I wasn't a criminal. We provided them with all the documentation under the sun about that, including, by the way, letters from the Department of Justice and the Securities and Exchange Commission confirming I had done nothing wrong, was never charged. And we figured that would be it. The top 10 media outlet, you know, respectable journalists, they would take it down, put in an editor's note, or make a correction. They refused. For over 2 years, my lawyers and I have been speaking with this top 10 media outlet. They will not put in a correction. They will not put in an editor's note.
Why not?
Why not? They've given absolutely no reason at all, not even a purported reason. They refuse to do so. And because the statute of limitations for libel is very short, I can't sue them. I can't force them to take it down. There's nothing I can legally do. Part of the Right to Be Forgotten bill changes the statute of limitations for internet libel, so it's 1 year from when the post comes down. So if someone does put something on the internet that's defamatory, that says that you beat your wife, beat your dog, cheated on your taxes, do drugs, whatever it is, the statute of limitations doesn't end only when you find out about it 2 years later. It actually lives until they take it down plus a year. And because I didn't have the statute of limitations, I couldn't go after them, and I could not enforce my rights. So then we went to Google, and my lawyers and I had a similar conversation with the head. I wrote to the heads of Google, Sergey Brin, Larry Page, Sundar Pichai, the president of Google Search, and I wrote to them, and I said, hey, you've got on the first page of my Google search that I committed a crime, referencing an article that says that I did not. I've sent you materials from my lawyers, letters from the SEC, letters from the DOJ confirming I'm 100% innocent, I was a witness, I never committed a crime. And what Google did is they apologized. Several attorneys there apologized. They felt sorry for me, having lost clients, having lost reputation, having lost multiple jobs, having lost a substantial part of my life savings, but Google wouldn't take it down. And the reason is they said they have a policy that without a court order, they won't take it down, no matter how defamatory, no matter how libelous. And that's how I got involved in this situation, because when someone says you're a criminal on the internet, and it's wrong and it's false, and no one disputes that, how can it be that there is not a single legal tool that I or my lawyers can use to force someone to take down something on the internet that says I'm a criminal when I'm not?
Okay. Scott Maloof, how do you feel about that?
Well, hey, first of all, John, I feel very much for you because, you know, obviously this is a real problem for you and there is no good remedy at law for the situation you're dealing with. But let me just take one issue with what you said. You said there's no prior restraint in this law. And Evan, what we mean by prior restraint is, you know, the government or a law says you, the public, you individuals cannot say something. You cannot speak. And obviously there are certain prior restraints like a gag order, but they're very, very narrow. But this law, I would argue, has a prior restraint in that it also says that if something is taken down, there can be no notice that something was taken down. There can be no collaboration with a person. So if I had to take down a post that I put up, I could not contact you and say, Evan, this came down. And so therein, to me, is an example of how this law is much, much broader than kind of what we've seen in Europe and why it does create some problems, because everyone would be at risk of this prior restraint as drafted by this law.
So, Scott, do we need a law of some kind?
I think, you know, the first place to reach out is to look at Google and Facebook and those arbiters of information to say, is this another place that you should be responding? You know, for example, their standard that they need a court order. You know, for John, he can't get one because this was probably first published well beyond when he first learned about it. There's about a year statute. And so he was not able to get into court. Their standard maybe should be something different where he's provided copious documentation and they should look at a takedown.
Okay, because it sounds to me like you think, first of all, just comparing the possible New York version of a Right to Be Forgotten law versus Europe, it's overbroad here.
Yes.
Okay. And then the broader question is, do we need something? And it sounds to me like, at the very least, someone like John, if I end up in his position, if you end up in his position, you feel like there's no recourse, you know, is that fair? I mean, for lack of a better word. So What would you change if you could change anything, Scott?
You know, I think the first place I would go is where I started, which is Facebook, Google, the folks who are controlling how people get to this information, and say, is this not an additional tool that you should use? So we've seen revenge porn, for example, become, you know, very prominent, and it's something that those communities have addressed. And so is this not a variant of that where, you know, John's in a bind, he's done everything. Should they not provide a similar kind of relief to help him get something when the law, you know, doesn't prevail? And it's also as a matter of good citizenship, because it is, you know, according to what John's provided to them, inaccurate. They haven't disputed it.
Okay, and so let me ask both Scott and then John the same question here, because as we look at how this law works in Europe and how it might work in a place like New York State, if there's a state version of this, again, the two prongs, inaccurate versus when we determine something becomes not relevant anymore. I have much more problem with inaccurate information easily accessible, because I'm listening to John's story, and again, we've done our best to vet it, and it does seem to be accurate. We're talking about ruining possible careers, costing someone a life fortune. We're talking about all kinds of things versus an arbitrary decision on when something is no longer relevant. I have much more of an issue, especially if employers say, well, wait, don't I get to decide when something is not relevant anymore? Don't you trust me to say, well, that this person did something stupid, but it was 10 years ago, or even it was last year, but you know what? People make mistakes versus inaccurate. To me, there's a big difference.
That's true. And also remember, the law also provides, where I'm looking at a copy of the proposed legislation, inadequate information or excessive information. And those two, you know, what is excessive information? If we have a million comments on something the president has done, is he able to say under this law, the million and first all the way up, those are excessive? You know, what does that mean?
Okay.
Yeah, Evan, hey, it's fine. Let me jump in for a quick second.
Yeah, go ahead.
You're raising some good points. First of all, this is the first draft of proposed legislation. I would invite your guests and anyone else who agrees that we do need some rules of the road, as I call them, but might have an issue or two with this provision or that provision, to contact the people who are sponsoring the bill and say, we generally support some rules of the road for the internet. We have an issue with this. We don't with that. And let's try to come up with something. And one more thought, too, about how this is playing out in Europe. For those who are not familiar with the right to be forgotten, in Europe, when the court ordered this, the folks at Google went literally apoplectic. The sky is falling. It's the end of the world. It's the end of the internet. I mean, literally apoplectic. You can see the articles from the time. But here we are several years later, and guess what? The sky is not falling. And by everyone's accounts, Google's accounts, social media experts' accounts, lawyers' accounts, it's working extremely well. Google is getting, as someone said, a substantial number of right-to-be-forgotten requests, and they are agreeing with and delinking from roughly 40%. And from the studies I've read, it's actually gone very well. The vast, vast, vast majority of the requests are either clearly being granted under Google's obligations under the European right to be forgotten. It's been a long time ago. It was something someone did or said to, but a long time ago. But if someone, you know, if it's a matter of public interest, or if it's a matter of a crime, or if it's a matter of a public official, it's clearly going the other way. So in other words, this is all new. The internet is now available to billions of people at one time, and we're sort of feeling things out. But it's actually worked extremely well in Europe. So hopefully we can go up with something in the States that also makes sense here.
Okay, and Scott, I know you want to raise a few points here before we get our only break of the hour. Go ahead, Scott.
Let me just raise four quick points, and I promise they'll be quick. These are actually from Google saying, here are examples of what kind of information people requested to be removed. Number one, from the UK, a public official asked us to remove a link to a student organization's petition demanding his removal. So the politician said, this is really unfavorable. Please take it down. They didn't remove that one. Second one, a high-ranking public official in Hungary asked Google to remove a recent article discussing decades-old criminal conviction. They didn't remove that. Okay, so that sounds like it's working. But then we have a case here from the UK where after they removed a news story about a minor crime, a newspaper published a story about the removal action. So the newspaper said, this is what information is available to you, the public, and here's how it's working. The Information Commissioner's Office ordered us, Google, is the us there, to remove the second story from the search results for the individual's name. We remove the page from the search results for the individual's name. So clearly there's an example of this law is not in Europe, where we've already agreed it's very narrow. It went out and grabbed a second story that, you know, was about removal of information. And here's the final one. An individual who's convicted of a serious crime in the last 5 years, whose conviction was quashed on appeal, asked us to remove an article about the incident. We removed the page from the search results for the individual's name. We just talked about that. That was the Connecticut case where we said, no, the Second Circuit said, no, we're not going to remove that information. We're not going to force people to remove it. So I think you got to be very careful about saying it's worked really successfully, because we've seen several examples of information that we wouldn't have access to, and some folks trying to manipulate that, such as the British politician or the Belgian who was convicted of a serious crime.
All right, John, anything you want to add to that?
Sure. I mean, look, don't let the perfect be the enemy of the good. By all accounts, some 90-plus percent have been pretty open and shut cases where it has worked in both directions. One thing I mentioned real quick before the break is you and your panelists and your listeners may also want to take a look at the recent endorsement of the New York State bill by the Association for Accountability and Internet Democracy, or AID, A-A-I-D. It is a leading European organization, an NGO with some top attorneys and internet experts, and AID, the Association for Accountability and Internet Democracy, recently came out in favor of the New York State bill. They're an extremely reasonable bunch of folks, and they have been working to help bring the best of the European right to be forgotten. And again, this is a first draft. There may be changes here, but to bring the largely successful European experience to the U.S. You may want to take a look at that.
All right, John, can you hang there for just a little bit more?
Absolutely.
All right, John's on the line with us sharing his story, and Scott Maloof, an attorney whose practice focuses on the intersection of social media and the law, is in studio. When we come back, we're going to talk to Annie Walker, who's a workshop specialist at Rochester Works. Yeah, I have a suspicion, I don't know, but my suspicion is that these kinds of stories, sometimes inaccurate stories, or at least pulling people in on a story that hits the news somewhere, impacts people who are struggling with poverty, struggling to find work, maybe disproportionately. You think about all the mugshots you see on the nightly news, and look, I worked in commercial television news. I had a problem with that for a long time. I think we really tar people in a way that can be, you know, for lack of a better word, permanent, or really follow them in hurtful ways. And I think we really need to think about that. And we're going to talk to someone from Rochester Works about, you know, how they work with people to make sure that understanding that the internet's forever, but also their thoughts on a potential law to help maybe mitigate some of that. So let's get our early break of the hour and come right back and continue the discussion. Coming up in our second hour, comedian Paula Poundstone joins us. She's coming back to Rochester, and maybe you saw her in Rochester last fall with the tour of Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. We had a great time with her there. We'll talk about her work next hour. Then in our second part of next hour, we talk to Mike Ingham, a Rochester native who is the U.S. Sailing Coach of the Year. His work coaching the Paralympic team to a silver in Rio. That and more next hour. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Annie Walker's on the line with us as well. She's a workshop specialist at Rochester Works. And Annie, I know everyone should know what Rochester Works is, but why don't you remind our listeners who don't?
Thank you very much for having us on. Rochester Works is America's Job Center. And we are here free of service to anyone that is working or not working to help anyone try and gain job stability. We offer a full range of services from workshops to counselors to funding to connecting to employers in the area.
How do you feel about what you've heard so far in this discussion, Annie? I mean, for a lot of us, me included, the notion of a right to be forgotten law is still pretty new. I know you work with people who are trying to get on their feet, trying to get more permanent work, trying to move ahead in their lives. How does the internet impact them, and how do you feel about what you're hearing?
Okay, I mean, let me tell you information we give in the workshops, because I'm the workshop specialist. We think at the beginning of everything, you have to be able to manage your own reputation. And so the best way to do that is to make sure that you're very cognizant, and I've heard people speaking about this as I've been listening. You have to be careful about what you do put out there. So that's Facebook and LinkedIn, et cetera. Some things you have control over, some things you don't. But for employers, they're going to go to things like LinkedIn, which is a professional networking tool, which is very much out there for over about 360 million people worldwide. And there you can manage, putting out there exactly what your work experience is, what your value is. And also Facebook, obviously, everybody's well aware of. So we challenge people to make sure that whatever they put out there, particularly on Facebook that is really out there and widespread, that they manage that not only for what they put on, but for what people that they're connected to might be putting on that might be shown to other people. When we talk to employers many times will say to us that, yes, they're going to absolutely go to LinkedIn and look at things. They may check in on Facebook. They're not stalking people on Facebook. They're getting the sense of, you know, of the person as a whole because they're looking for fit. And so does, you know, does something in Google impact somebody? It may possibly, but what we're hoping people do and what we're hearing from employers is what they would like to do is they're managing and talking to people to find out the relevancy of what's out there. And so I think that's a critical piece. As far as what I understand about the law, I haven't done a great detail of research on it. I was just researching it now this morning. I think anything that can be put into effect that is going to be credible, that is going to be equitable, that's going to allow people to be able to at least have a conversation about what the relevancy or irrelevancy of that information is going to be one of the things that we should all have, because I think we all might make a mistake, might make an error, something might get on, but I think it, at any point we need to have a conversation to find out the relevancy of what was written versus how that's going to impact an employer from having a valuable employee.
Annie, I'd like to read an email I got from a listener named Mike this morning. And Mike, in general, I think, does not necessarily support this kind of law, whether the European version or a potential New York version. He supports free flow of information, but he did say this. Mike says, quote, "I think the real issue is society's lack of compassion and moral scapegoating. People make mistakes. We drink too much at parties. We play stupid pranks. We say intemperate things. Hopefully, at the same time, learning lessons and changing our behavior, evolving, if you will, as a more well-rounded and hopefully wiser person. Unfortunately, as a society, we haven't learned to live and let live, to give someone a chance and see where it goes. Everything is considered to be high stakes all the time, and it's not." That's from Mike. Annie, what do you think about that? This notion that, you know, an employer might Google something and find an intemperate remark or an ill-considered interview or those kinds of things. And instead of saying, look, as a person, have I made mistakes? They think, well, eliminate this person. You know, this person's out of the search. Do we have to be more forgiving of people's pasts, Annie?
I agree with Mike on what he's saying, absolutely. I also believe that I'm seeing a trend. True, not all, but a lot of employers, they're doing exactly what Mike is saying, that they are giving people the opportunity to have a discussion, to be able to give them a second chance, to be able to really find out more and make their own decisions. You know, unfortunately, you know, you can't take back what is said. We teach our children that. And so I think that as a society, we need to step back and really seek to understand, and I think that's what Mike is saying. And what I'm seeing from the employers that we interact with here, that are here in our recruitment events, they are seeking to understand. They want to be able to find someone that may not have had a perfect background, but that is now, you know, going to go forward in a different manner with different behaviors, and is going to become a valuable employee to them. So it's not a perfect world. I agree with a lot of what Mike says. I think there's a lot of things that we need to change, but that's going to be changed from us individually. I'm just happy to be able to say to you from my perspective that the interaction we're seeing with employers is that many of them are taking that step that Mike was talking about earlier.
Okay, and Annie, before I let you go, one more quick question for you. You know, my opinion on this law doesn't matter. I'm the host of the program, but I can tell you honestly, I don't know yet how I really feel about this, because my instinct is to say, especially as a journalist, that the free flow of information should be a big, big consideration, that I'm in favor as much as we can of sharing information. You know, in free speech matters, I always think more speech is a pretty good antidote for speech we don't like. Obviously, there might be exceptions, and I'm always willing to listen, but my instinct is generally not to eliminate or to tamp down information. But I understand a lot of the concerns, whether it's John or why the European law happened. I understand why those things come up. But my feeling on this is, and maybe you can speak a little bit to this, Annie, is we discriminate in our society in a lot of different ways. People of color face discrimination, clearly. People in poverty face discrimination. People in poverty are perhaps more likely to have either a criminal record or to appear in these kinds of stories. And I feel like that might open the door to more discrimination or at least more judgment. And I wonder if you feel that that is true.
I think that, you know, as a society, it's not one particular demographic or another. I think that we just tend to jump before we have the whole story. And so, and because something is written and it's out there on the internet, you don't know the intent by which it was written. So let me give you my take on that. Mm-hmm. It's like if I went into a restaurant and I didn't like the dinner I got served, and I went in and put it on Yelp or whatever, okay? Now, that's out there forever. That could be a phenomenal restaurant. But if I have people that only believe in that, and they go in and they look at that, then somebody might be losing business, which is, so I tend to look at things and say, that's great. Let me take that into consideration, but let me find out for myself. And so, you know, I think we have free flow of information, but I'm concerned about the relevancy and the credibility of the free flow of information that we have out there. And so my goal is to help our members make sure that the information that they give out through their actions, through their interactions, through their resumes, through their networking, through their LinkedIn, through their Facebook, is relevant enough and credible enough for employers to want to have that conversation so that they can see about the, you know, bringing them in as sustainable employees.
Annie, thank you. Annie is a workshop specialist at Rochester Works. Thanks for calling the program today and joining the discussion.
Thank you so much for having us.
We continue the discussion with Scott Maloof in studio, an attorney whose practice is focused on the intersection of social media and law. And on the line, we've got John, who is a man who we just got in touch with today. He called us understanding that we were going to be talking about right-to-be-forgotten laws. His story has been a kind of model for a potential law in New York State, or at least kind of a warning about potential harm to inaccurate stories being easily found on Google and how they can impact someone's reputation, their earnings, their life. And so we're allowing John to use a pseudonym, but we've been able to vet his story as accurate, and John is on the program as well. So Scott Maloof, a couple of things. She brought up Yelp, and you and I have talked about Yelp on a separate show in the past on different
sure.
stuff. Was that a fair comparison in your mind with what she was saying there about Yelp, comparing that to how that might tarnish someone's reputation fairly or unfairly?
Well, I think Yelp is an interesting example. First, you know, as we last talked, the Consumer Review Fairness Act has been passed by Congress, applies all over the country, which says basically any business cannot have a form contract that forbids Yelp reviews or similar kinds of reviews. And so, you know, I don't think we're going to see the sky fall because people are free to go out and put Yelp reviews on. Secondly, you know, businesses have received negative Yelp reviews. And if you see 20 positive reviews and one negative review, I think it gives more credibility to say this is a legitimate source. And businesses overcome it. And third, there have been businesses who say, we absolutely reject Yelp. We celebrate our one-star reviews. Come in and find out who we are. So I don't think it's an apt comparison because, you know, businesses have more resources. But if to the extent it is there, businesses have overcome negativity.
I know there's something you wanted to follow up with John as well. So
well,
go ahead.
I just want to ask you, John, you know, in thinking about and reading the bill, there's the $250 a day penalty.
For what?
For, you know, if you receive a request or if the request goes to the Secretary of State, it's not quite clear to me on reading this bill. To remove information, if you don't do it, there's a $250 a day penalty.
For Google, for example.
Well, it could go to the Google, and Google, a search engine, an indexer, or the poster, the person who posts, or a person who puts a link up.
Okay.
Any of those four people. So anyone listening who uses social media or who uses the internet could be someone who could receive this. So my question to John is, John, don't you think this is going to chill a lot of speech by people who use social media when they receive a letter that says you are possibly subject to a $250 a day charge or fine from us because you've posted excessive or irrelevant information? Don't you think a lot of people are just going to self-censor immediately without understanding what is or isn't protected by the law?
Listen, I appreciate the question. As a former attorney and journalist and a big free speech proponent, and what I said before I think applies. Let's start the conversation about what the rules are going to be for the road with the internet, and let's have a conversation and sit down. My guess is 99.9% of bills have revisions from their first introduction. Let's have a conversation. I want to make just two quick points also about what someone said before about doing the right thing. You know, a lot of this is if people did the right thing, we wouldn't be in this situation. So if the major media outlet that wrongly said I committed a crime had taken my name out or corrected the article or put in an editor's note or did anything basically humanly decent that you would want if yourself or a loved one or your child was wrongly said to have committed a crime on the internet and in a major media publication, I wouldn't be on the phone with you and your listeners right now. If Google, when they got all this evidence that this major media outlet wrote an article saying that I committed a crime when I didn't, if they had done the right thing instead of just apologizing and de-linked my name from that article, we wouldn't be on the phone right now. The problem is that not everybody does. I want to also tell Annie one thing she should know for her clients, too. Judge Gleeson, G-L-E-E-S-O-N, in the Eastern District of New York, in 2015, on May 21st, issued an extraordinary opinion in a case called Jane Doe versus U.S. Jane Doe had committed a relatively minor crime years ago. She did her service, whatever that was an outstanding citizen by every account. Judge Gleeson did something extraordinary, a federal judge. He expunged her conviction, her 13-year-old conviction, expunged it decade later because she could not get a job and was threatened with homelessness because of the conviction and because of the ubiquity of the Internet. It's an extraordinary opinion, the only one to my knowledge, where a federal judge literally expunged a conviction because of extraordinary hardship of a woman who was, at this point, a model citizen, but was threatened with homelessness because employers couldn't get past it and because they weren't forgiving, and because of the Internet, and it was following her around for the rest of her life. Again, just something for Annie and her clients to look at and for us to have a conversation about. And one last point, too. This is not just happening in Europe. In Australia, there was recently a landmark decision in favor of a woman named Janice Duffy, D-U-F-F-Y. There was some defamatory, false, and libelous information harming her substantially. She went to Google. She presented all the evidence. Google gave her the standard answer, the one they gave me. We're sorry. We apologize. We don't do anything about it. And an Australian court granted her a judgment against Google, forcing Google to take it down. And the head of AID, the organization I mentioned before, Dan Sheppard, he also secured in Europe, I believe in France, a landmark judgment against Google as well. Because what's happening here is, can Google simply throw up their hands and Facebook throw up their hands and say, we have no liability? For example, we haven't mentioned yet the Communications Decency Act, or the CDA. Section 230 of the CDA, subsection C, 230C, has been argued by Google to say that they are not liable for anything that they do on Google, no matter what, and they have complete and total immunity. Even if Google has been shown documents proving that what they're linking to is false, libel, defamatory, ruining people's lives, ruining their careers. And that's Google's position. In the Australia case, the court rejected those arguments, and there are some people in this country who are saying, we now have to relook at the Communications Decency Act. It was passed 12 years ago, back in the days of Windows XP, if anybody remembers Windows XP, and back in the days where the best phone you could buy was a flip phone, where you could send a text, but you couldn't access the Internet. And there's a movement to revise 230C of the CDA to say that if you, Google, are shown evidence that you're linking to a false and defamatory article, you've got to de-link from it. And it's a shame that there has to be a groundswell of legislators and attorneys and people whose lives have been destroyed trying to bring some common sense to the Internet, when if Google just did the right thing in the first place, or if this major media outlet did, we wouldn't be having these discussions.
We're down to our last minute here. We could probably get into the weeds on the legalese for the next couple of hours. But, Scott, you got about 30 seconds. Final thoughts.
I will keep it super fast. Communications Decency Act 230, technically what it says is Google's not liable for third-party posts. They're only responsible for their own activities. Third, people would tell you that that has been responsible for the growth of all the Internet companies. The services that we now have available would not have grown without 230. And finally, always keep in mind, there are policy issues here. If we make choices based upon emotion, based upon individual stories, we're going to lose out in a bigger policy thing, so we have to keep that in mind.
All right, and John, some final thoughts from you. Do you think New York State will revive this effort anytime soon?
Well, right now the bill is pending in the Assembly, and it's being discussed both in the Assembly and also with senators. And I'd like to invite anyone to join the conversation to come up with something that works. You know, real briefly, you know, it's sort of like the issue of guns. It's a very hot-button topic, and people are very absolutist one way or the other. And some people, if you have any sort of restrictions or rules about guns, they think it's the end of the world. Everyone's going to take their guns away. And I've heard some of the same kind of rhetoric here about censorship and the Internet and everything else. You know, but at the end of the day, if someone says someone's a criminal and they're not, there should be some way that that person, in this case me, who is not a criminal and no one disputes it, can get that posting taken down from the Internet. And similarly, people who made one dumb decision and had a few too many drinks 10 years ago, we should have a discussion as a society about it and start seeing what makes sense and what doesn't make sense, and have, as I said, some rules of the road to what's going on online.
John, good luck to you. Thanks for getting in touch with us, and we do appreciate you sharing your story.
Thank you.
And Scott Maloof, always great learning from you, sir. I have a feeling this is one we're going to have to continue to follow because, you know, whether it's a New York State version or others, I suspect these kinds of issues won't necessarily go away here.
No, they will not. Thank you for having me.
Always good to have you, Scott. That's Scott Maloof. Online where, by the way, Scott?
www.scottmaloof.com, as well as at Scott Maloof on Twitter.
MALOUF, scottmaloof.com. More connections straight ahead.